G'day, welcome to the Fasting Highway podcast. I'm Graham Curry, your host from Perth, Australia. I lost 60 kilos or 132 pounds living an intermittent fasting lifestyle, and I successfully maintained that weight loss now coming up 2 years. I wanted to bring this series of podcasts to you to give you an insight into what it's like to living an intermittent fasting lifestyle. I'm also the author of the book, The Fasting Highway, which is a story of my journey overcoming chronic addiction to fast food and sugar and taking that walk from morbid obesity to normality. So sit back here with us on the Fasting Highway in the next few weeks and listen to some inspiring guests and some experts in the intermittent fasting community. And thank you for joining us. Enjoy the show. G'day, welcome to the Fasting Highway, and this is episode 44. So today I'm going to be joined by Dr. Avishkar Sabharwal. And Dr. Sabharwal has trained in internal medicine in both India and the United States and is board certified in obesity medicine and lifestyle medicine. His focus area has always been lifestyle diseases, especially obesity. His experience in India made him profoundly interested in the effects of nutrition on health and disease. He researched metabolic syndrome, which is often the outcome of obesity, during his MD in India. Dr. Sabharwal is a member of the Obesity Medicine Association, wherein he has been actively involved in the Speakers Bureau Committee. He is also a member of the Lipid Association of India and has been a speaker at various webinars throughout the country, highlighting the importance of recognizing obesity and metabolic syndrome in cardiovascular health. And welcome to the podcast, Dr. Avishkar Sabharwal. Oh, g'day, Dr. Sabharwal, and thank you for joining me today on the Fasting Highway. I really appreciate your time. I just thought we might start off by looking at your early days with your medical career and when you first started training for medicine and what led you up to specializing in the obesity field.
You know, throughout my younger days, basically seeing patients, I think that probably played a role in me choosing medicine as a field. But really, I got into obesity primarily because I myself suffered from obesity. In fact, the way I put it is I still have obesity and it's just in remission. And the reason why I say that is because basically, obesity is a chronic disease, and we need to treat it as such. Now, a lot of this I didn't know when I was studying medicine. So I studied medicine in India, then I studied medicine in the US, and then I ended up studying for obesity medicine. So I didn't know all of this till I actually studied for obesity medicine, a lot that I know now. And this really gave me a better perspective of what this disease is all about. And yeah, it was my personal journey that really led me to kind of get here.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So you just mentioned there obesity is a disease. And yet a lot of people, doctor, think that obese people just have no discipline or willpower. Yet some of the most successful people on earth and professionals are obese. Can you just explain why, in fact, obesity is a disease?
Well, so, you know, you put it very rightly that there's so many successful people in this world who are actually suffering from obesity. So it's not about willpower, really. You know, if you talk about willpower, the way I put it is what happened 30, 40 years ago when this really became an epidemic? Did we suddenly lose our willpower with regards to our health? And we just decided to keep willpower regarding everything else but our health as a community, as a society, as humans. What happened? So I don't think that's the answer. The other aspect of this is that we understand that there are a lot of hormonal changes that take place in the disease of obesity. There are, of course, certain things that can predispose somebody to obesity. There are multiple other causes of obesity. There are various things that are related to obesity, which predispose an individual to suffering from this disease. And so we understand it's much more complex than people make it out to be. Now, at the outset, it seems very simple. It's just basically stored energy in the form of fat. But it's really much more complex because everything, a lot of the things in our body are basically controlled by our hormones. So it's much more complex.
Yeah. So what is the answer to the obesity epidemic, Doctor? How are we going to either slow it down or educate people about it?
I think the first thing to do is just spread the knowledge, spread the word. That's where we start. Now, if you or I or anybody tries to go out and change the society, that's not going to happen, realistically. Where we can start is by changing ourselves and the way we think about things. So what I try to do through my podcast is basically spread this information because, when I started on this journey, I did not know about this. I, like everybody else, thought it's my problem, it's my fault, and I need to do something about it. I did not know, and this is despite having studied medicine, so I did not know about this. So what we can do is spread the awareness and spread the knowledge about this. There is enough data to support all of this. We just need more people to know about it. And I think that's probably where we need to start. It's, of course, a long, long journey for us as a race, as a human race. It's going to be a long journey because it's very complex, the forces at play over here that are causing us to be in this pandemic. I call it not the other pandemic, is the obesity that we're in right now.
Yeah, so with obesity, Doctor, I know when I was morbidly obese, how it affected my mental state. What's the correlation between obesity and people's mental state in your experience?
Oh, wow. Yeah, it's so closely interlinked. I mean, we know from data that depression and obesity are interlinked. So there's a bidirectional relationship. That means if somebody has depression, they have an increased risk of having obesity. And if somebody has obesity, then they have an increased risk of having depression. That's just one. Of course, there's the whole concept of weight bias, fat shaming, which also makes people much more conscious, much more have a sad mood, have more anxiety, a lot of other issues that go into it. And then the other aspect is also certain psychiatric disorders that are fairly well recognized. For example, binge eating disorder is a recognized disorder. Nighttime eating syndrome, these are eating disorders that we know about. Bulimia, we know about these disorders. Now, they may lead to obesity, or they may be the cause of obesity, but until and unless these diseases are treated, we're not going to be able to treat the obesity. So it's so important to understand all of this. And then on top of that, if you look at some of the psychiatric medications that are available, we know that some of these medications can cause weight gain. That is commonly seen in patients who are on these medications. For no fault of theirs, because they have to be on these medications, they gain the weight because of these medications. So, this is it's a very complex issue when it comes to the mental state per se and obesity.
Yeah, it is. And I know after losing 132 pounds or 60 kilos, how much my mental state changed. It changed completely and it really flipped around. And so there definitely is a correlation there. And just how you think about yourself. And I think when you are trying to make that path from morbid obesity to normality, you've really got to start doing things like loving yourself first and get into a positive mindset.
Yeah, we talk about four pillars of treatment in obesity, four pillars of management. We talk about nutrition, we talk about exercise, we talk about, these medications and surgeries. And then the fourth pillar is actually your mental changes or the mindset shift. And that plays a very key role because there our emotions actually play a very big part in how we are as humans and how we interact with each other and how we interact with ourselves. So that's a very key part that really needs to be taken care of when dealing with anybody with obesity.
Yeah, I sort of feel the mental side of it, doctors, is probably more, to me, it's almost 90% of the whole journey for me. It has been about that mindset shift. And once I was able to start thinking about myself more positively and get myself into a better mindset, it really helped.
No, absolutely. I mean, I couldn't agree more, yeah. It's very, very critical.
Yeah. So people often talk about the calorie in, calorie out approach, and people's first sort of reaction that don't have a weight problem is just eat less, move more. So is the calorie in, calorie out approach to overcoming obesity the correct way, or does it have its flaws?
So I would say yes and no. Yes, because it does work. I mean, at the end of the day, we do have an excess of calories. And calories basically a form of measuring energy, right? So we do have excess stored energy in some form or the other. So we have it stored in the form of fat in our body. And so it is, to some extent, it's true, because if it were completely false, then obviously reducing calories wouldn't work. But then it's also false because that's not the whole picture. Because it's incomplete to say that it's just about calories. It's so much more, because everything in our body is influenced by the hormones. Now, when we do go into this calorie in, calorie out model, what the problem that we're facing is also the fact that we are basically equating all the foods. 100 calories of broccoli will not be the same as 100 calories of cookies. But if you just look at the calorie in, calorie out model, you're saying that they're the same, which is completely not true. The way broccoli will interact in your body is going to be completely different from the way 100 calories of cookies are going to interact in your body. And we're also taking away the fact that, you know, we are actually more microbes than we are humans. We have more microbiome, more bacteria in our gut than we have actually human cells. So they interact with the food that we eat. What we eat is also food for them. And for us to have a good, healthy gut flora is also important, because now we're also discovering that the gut microbiota may have a role to play in our obesity and so many other things as it pertains to our health. And so really, it's very different. Now, I'll give you a very simple example. For example, you take 100 calories of cookies, and I'm just going to use broccoli and cookies again. The 100 calories of the broccoli are going to actually come encased in basically a casing of fiber, which is not going to be the case in the case of cookies. So what ends up happening is that all of the products in the cookies are more available to your gut to absorb them, which are not so available in the case of broccoli. So the whole point is also how much of it is actually absorbed. When we count calories, or when we calculate calories in a food, that's done in a lab situation where you burn the food and you basically see how much of energy is released. And then you kind of use whatever calculations and then figure out, okay, this is the amount of calories that this food would have. But we're not talking about how much of it is actually available to us, or how much of it is actually absorbed. And that too may vary from person to person. You may absorb some more calories, I may absorb less calories, or the other way around. And so it's very variable, but it is true, because it does work. So I would say that, you know, it's yes and no. Calories do work, but that's not the whole story.
Yeah, a lot of people don't actually know the scientific explanation of what a calorie is. Can you just go into that for a minute?
Sure, yeah. So a calorie is basically a measure of energy. Just like we use kilojoules, we use calories. So it's just in a laboratory, you burn anything, it's going to produce heat. And when that heat is produced, when we measure that heat, so it's just a measure of how much of the heat is produced.
Yeah. And so in your experience, Dr. Sabharwal, what is the most successful treatment for obesity, and how do you sort of deal with that with your patients that you're seeing?
So, Graham, actually, there is no one specific treatment for obesity. I wish there were. If there were, whoever would discover it would be a billionaire or a trillionaire, because there is no one specific treatment. It really has to be individualized to the patient. There are so many variables. There are so many things that can cause obesity. And so actually, we have to find what's causing the obesity before we can figure out how we can help the patient. A lot of times, lifestyle changes will work. Sometimes patients require medication. Sometimes they just require tweaking of their medications to actually help them get rid of the obesity or control their obesity. So there are a lot of things at play. Now, but a lot of times, you know, changing the lifestyle does help. We have surgeries, we have medications. There are so many approaches. There's no one right answer to it.
Yeah, and I guess it'd be a magic pill, wouldn't it, if we could just take some sort of pill and all of a sudden not be obese. But yeah, I guess I was more there's so much science around now and just all the various studies that it sometimes is confusing for obese people about what path to take, I guess.
Right. No, it's difficult. But again, it's very individualized. And that's the thing. I think that's true for any disease for that matter, because we really have to see what's causing the disease. And that's what we try to do with anything in medicine. We try to figure out what's causing the disease and then try to get to the root cause of the disease.
Yeah. And speaking of which, what are some of the other diseases that are associated with obesity that can become real problems?
Gosh, yeah. I mean, obesity affects everything. We just talked about depression. It increases the risk of strokes, heart disease, high blood pressure, diabetes, cancers, infertility, PCOD, you name it. It affects like almost all the organs, fatty liver disease. It affects everything. So it's one thing that leads to so many other diseases.
Yeah, so there's a lot of whys there, isn't there, for an obese person to think about. And I know I had a history of cancer in my family, and I sort of thought, well, at least if I can get myself out of this obesity, I can give myself half a chance, I guess.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it leads to so many other diseases. So that's why it's so critical to actually tackle this problem.
You talked about obesity being a pandemic, and I agree with you on that 100%. Why do you think it is getting worse, the obesity pandemic? Is there any sort of particular reasons that this is happening? Is it correlating with the more access to the higher processed foods and fast foods and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I think so. I think what really changed was when we entered the low-fat era was primarily all the sugars that were pumped into the market. And I think that kind of tipped the balance in the wrong direction, because we know that it's not necessarily the fats that cause people to have obesity. It's probably more of the sugars and the more high processed foods. Now, it's a little more complex because the highly processed foods also are sort of addictive. So it's not just the nutritional part of it, but also the fact that they do act on the same receptors and they do activate the same pathways that the addictive substances would. Now, we know about this because there are studies in mice that do suggest that sugar is actually more addictive than cocaine. So they hijack the same pathways, and that's why we crave more of these foods. And then they're marketed to us much more, and they're more easily available in the market. So all of this is, I think, playing into the fact that we are kind of in this place where we are now. And the other thing is that our lives have become much more busy. So we are always looking for quick fixes. We are always looking for a quick answer. And that's what's really happening. I mean, everybody is looking for a fast way to get something. And sometimes fast is not the best way.
No, and I mean, it's become so prevalent now that you don't even have to leave your couch, doctor. You can just sit there and push a couple of buttons on your phone and Uber Eats will bring you food, and you don't even have to get up and stand up anymore. But I mean, what is the answer? I mean, no one knows, as you said, but with sugar, I mean, you may or may not heard of me talk about, I was a chronic sugar addict myself. And I decided that the only way I was going to beat it was just going cold turkey on it, basically, and just stopping it. Yeah. So if an obese person does have a very, very bad sugar addiction, what is the best way to address that? Is it cold turkey, or what's the best process?
You know, Graham, in all honesty, I don't know if there is a best way for treating sugar addiction, because I'm not an addiction specialist. So I wouldn't be able to comment on what modalities an addiction specialist will be able to use to treat sugar addiction. What I can tell you is what I did myself, because I know that I used to crave sugar a lot. And I went basically cold turkey, just like you did. And what ended up happening was that after about a week, or probably more, slightly more than that, maybe 2 weeks, I stopped craving the sugar. And that's what happened to me. Now, I did not have any, some people do have these withdrawals, so to say, but I did not experience any withdrawals for myself. But once I was beyond that, I did not crave the sugar anymore. That's what I can tell you for sure. But as far as the addiction goes, the addiction part goes, it's not a physiological addiction per se. I believe it's more of a psychological addiction. The difference is basically physiological would be when you start seeing specific symptoms of it, just like you would see if somebody has, say, alcohol addiction or somebody suffering from opiate addiction. So when they start withdrawing, there'll be certain specific physical symptoms that they will have. Psychological addiction is usually what you see with, say, caffeine. When you get off caffeine, you start having headaches, you just have a foggy feeling, stuff like that. It's not physical symptoms that you will have. So, I wouldn't be able to comment on which is the best way to get off sugar, but I think people should certainly try and get off sugar. The thing that I recommend people doing, at least for starters, is looking when you're buying foods in a grocery store or online, just look at the label and see if there are any added sugars there. I think that's the first place to start.
Yeah, and sometimes that's difficult too because there's so many different names for sugar now, doctor.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say that because, you know, it's interesting. This happened to me. I was in the grocery store and I was buying something for myself. I was basically buying a frozen dinner and it said 0 grams added sugar. Now over here, they do mention 0 gram. I mean, basically, they mention added sugar, whether it's there or not. And it said 0 grams added sugar. So I was just about to buy it and I just looked at the ingredients and it said cane sugar. And I was like, are you kidding me? You just said, like, the label says 0 grams added sugar. Why is there sugar in the ingredients when it says 0 grams added sugar? So yeah, you have to be very careful when you're buying these things. And they come in so many different forms, right? You can have agave, honey, regular cane sugar. Sometimes they'll put an organic in front of it as if that's healthier sugar. So there are so many ways that they can really trick you. High fructose corn syrup. Then there's this whole debate about whether high fructose corn syrup is worse or cane sugar is worse. I mean, really, there's not much of a difference between the two. Cane sugar is 50% fructose, 50% glucose. High fructose corn syrup is 55% fructose, 45% glucose. So there's not a host of a difference between the two. And so you're right. You're absolutely right. They basically hide it in so many names under so many garbs. And you really have to be very careful when you're buying online or, you know, in the grocery store.
Yeah, I think it's just a case of educating yourself about it. Absolutely. I know when I shopped at the supermarket or what you guys call the big box stores, I tended to shop around the circumference of the store where usually you had the fruit and veggies and then you had the dairy and the meat section and that sort of thing. And I found by staying out of these aisles, so I found that's where most of the processed added sugars were, in the aisles.
No, that's absolutely right. That's what we tell our patients also. Just walk around the periphery, buy foods that don't have a label on them, and you should be good.
That's great. I just wanted to touch a bit about your own sort of story with obesity. Doctor, have you always struggled with your weight through your life?
Through my life, yes, but not for the last few years. Not for the last four, I would say, probably more than that, probably 5 years or so.
I haven't struggled with it.
Yeah, because I've been able to maintain it. So before that, it was tough.
Yeah. So let's talk about intermittent fasting now. And I know you have an interest in it.
Oh, yeah.
How did you first become interested in intermittent fasting? What brought you to that?
So really, you know, I was I used to listen to another podcast on intermittent fasting, and I really got interested in intermittent fasting because this was a new technique, and I wanted to try it just because I wanted to try it. I had already lost my weight, so it wasn't like I was trying to lose weight at that time, but it was just a modality that I was very, very curious about, and this came about, this whole concept of intermittent fasting. And then I was at a conference on obesity and they were talking about intermittent fasting and how the different modalities are. So I got really interested in this. So I wanted to try it for myself and see what it really feels like. And then, of course, I found Jason Fung's book and The Obesity Code. And then I did go through that book and I decided, let's just try this. Let's give it a try and see what it does. So I tried it. I think it's something if you can do, you should do it. So I think it's a good way to go if you can do it.
So I guess you being a doctor and looking at the science of things in your research that you've done into intermittent fasting, can you just explain to people what some of the main benefits are, just maybe aside from the weight loss?
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, You see, intermittent fasting, when you look at intermittent fasting, most of the data that we have is on alternate day fasting. So we know, as you would know, Graham, there are different types of intermittent fastings, right? There's a 16-8, there's a 24, there's 5-2, that's like 5 days of regular food and 2 days of fasting. There's alternate day fasting. There are tons of ways that you can do this, the whole fasting thing. I think the way I look at fasting is primarily that fasting, at least what I understand from the way it's used, is primarily that it achieves a state of ketosis. And I think that's probably what the aim is of fasting. Now, most of the data with that we do have is on actually alternate day fasting, which I do not know if it achieves ketosis or not. But what they found was that even with when they compared it to the reduced calorie diet, when you look at the alternate day fasting versus the patients were eating the same amount of calories as they would in a reduced calorie diet, and then in the alternate day fasting diet, they found some benefit with the alternate day fasting and, you know, in their metabolic milieu and whatever. But the way I look at it is there are different ways to look at intermittent fasting. One, like I said, so if you're looking at the 16-8 diet, then there's this whole concept of chrononutrition. And there's a researcher by the name Dr. Sachidanand Panda. He does a lot of research on chrononutrition. So when you look at his data, basically they found that also it's not just the fact that you're not eating for a certain amount of time, but also what time of the day you're eating and what time of the day you're not eating is also important. So in his book, he had mentioned primarily data from mice. And then what he found was that if you're actually, if the mice were eating when they were not supposed to eat, and they ate the same amount of food as the other mice that were eating in there during their active phase or when they were awake and, you know, they were supposed to eat, they actually gained the weight. So it kind of suggests that it's not just the fact that you're fasting, but it's also when you're doing it is important. And then Jason Fung, of course, has his own practice where he does a lot of fasting, which he's had a lot of results with it. So, you know, this is a very interesting field where we're finding so much more because there are so many other variables to it than just the fact that you're fasting. There is how frequently you do it, when you do it. There's another researcher, Dr. Longo, and he's looking at how fasting can help with longevity. So that's another fascinating field that we are exploring now with intermittent fasting. And the beauty of it all is that this is nothing new. This has existed for so long, for so many centuries with us, in different cultures. Almost all cultures have fasting in some way or the other, right? So it's very fascinating.
It is. And as you say, it's been around for centuries and basically since time began, really, because, you know, the hunters and gatherers when food was scarce and that sort of thing. And I guess it's not so much about what you eat. Well, it is to a point, but also when you eat. And I know just by delaying that process, you just give your body that time, don't you? Just run us through that, what that sort of fasting period does for our body and our organs and that sort of thing. And so maybe touch on the autophagy.
Yeah. So fasting, what it does is basically what ends up happening is when you're not eating, your kind of insulin levels go down. And when we talk with regards to obesity, we know that insulin is a big driver of obesity. And then your insulin level goes down. You kind of, if you have a very prolonged fast, like what Jason Fung does for some of his patients, that would lead to a state of ketosis. That is something that would be similar to a ketogenic diet. So when you have a very low carb diet, the whole idea being that if you're going to be in a state of ketosis, what's going to end up happening is that you're going to, ketones are, the way you enter a ketotic state is when you start burning the fat, and that produces ketones. So your body is going to be using the ketones as a source of fuel, because our body can use ketones as a source of fuel, rather than glucose that is normally from the carbohydrates. So it kind of is similar to the way your ketosis or ketogenic diet would work. But the other thing with the ketogenic diet or with intermittent fasting is that once you reach a state of ketosis, your hunger also goes down. Now, what I also notice and what everybody who does intermittent fasting tells me is that, of course, hunger comes in waves. You'll feel very hungry for a little bit, and then it kind of goes away. Initially, when you start doing intermittent fasting, what ends up happening is because you're not eating as many carbs as you would, normally you start losing a lot of water. So the weight that comes off initially is the water weight, because carbohydrates retain water. And so that's the initial weight that comes off. And then gradually, if you start going into the state of ketosis, that's when you start using your fat to kind of sustain yourself, maintain yourself. A lot of times people have what we call the keto flu. Even it'll be seen, you know, some patients with intermittent fasting will see that is basically a foggy feeling that they have. Now, I'll be honest, I did not experience that, but I wasn't probably doing it for those extended periods so as to kind of be in a state of ketosis. So that's why I probably didn't experience it.
Yeah, and so what was your sort of fasting protocol? Did you just switch that around much?
I did. So initially I started with 16:8, then I went to 24. The longest I fasted was about 44 or 45 hours. So that was the longest I went. I just wanted to see how long I could go. But I do not recommend anybody doing any of that, of course, without being under the supervision of a physician who knows about fasting and who knows how to monitor patients, because it can be tricky. And of course, if somebody is on certain medications, especially for diabetes, high blood pressure and everything, it's very critical that these patients are monitored by the physician while they're undertaking this, because these medications need to be altered when they're going through this fast.
Absolutely. And I think anybody really has to discuss any health plan with their doctor. So please do that. And I noticed too, doctor, that we see a lot in intermittent fasting groups where sometimes people use fasting as punishment for overeating on the weekend or something like that. And then they think they have to do these longer fasts to somehow make up. And I think that's not a great mindset myself.
I agree. I don't think so. I think the way I look at fasting is it's actually another tool in our toolbox. I don't think it's a punishment. If you start looking at things as punishments, then that's not the point. When we try to do anything for ourselves, I think we have to be in a mental space where we are happy about what we're doing. It should not be a chore and it should not be a punishment. Because at the end of the day, if you look at the larger picture, I think what all of us are trying to achieve is just basically be in a happy state. Whatever may be, whatever size we may be at, whatever may be the case, we just want to be in a happy state of mind. And if something is going to feel like pain to you, I don't think it's worth doing it unless, you know, somebody's forcing you to do it, which is, again, obviously not right.
Yeah, absolutely, 100% correct. So let's talk a minute about what we call clean fasting, doctor. What's your sort of opinion when people are fasting and keeping that fast as clean as possible?
So that's what I used to do. I used to clean fast. I used to drink water, but that was it. Clean and basically coffee without any creamer or anything, none of that. So I used to do a clean fast. That's the way I think I would want to do it. If people don't want to do it, again, like I said, the way I look at fasting is another way of achieving a state of ketosis or a very low carbohydrate state. And what happens is that if you do want to basically have something, you should have something which is going to be either relatively high in fat, because fat doesn't cause the insulin surge, or high in proteins. Now, even then, some of the proteins can cause, I would say plant-based proteins would probably be a shade better than animal-based proteins or whey protein, which can cause a higher insulin spike. But overall, I think I would rather do a clean fast than do something with, eat something. Now, having said that, when you talk about the alternative fasting, that's not a clean fast necessarily. That's usually eating about 500, 600 calories on the day when you're fasting and then eating a regular meal on the day when you're not fasting. But even with that, even doing that, not doing a clean fast, even doing that, people have seen there is data to suggest that that's also good. So it's an evolving science that we're discovering more and more about. as we go along.
Yeah, so with the medical community, are you seeing much of a shift over the years, like since you've been involved in it, towards thinking about intermittent fasting? Yeah, towards
Fasting. You know, it's interesting because nobody talked about it till recently. I think probably because Jason Fung brought it to so many people's attention. It really existed in a lot of the religious communities, or you know, with which was very much strictly associated with the religion. Having said that, science has always been open to all of this. So in the field of obesity, I can tell you for sure there's a lot of interest in intermittent fasting, because I had mentioned, right, I was actually at a conference when we heard about all of the studies that are going into intermittent fasting. So definitely it is a field of great interest to us, and I find it very fascinating, honestly.
Yeah, and I know a lot of people, they go to very obese people, they get that message sometimes about the weight loss reduction surgery and all that. And, you know, for me, I had a couple of doctors say that to me, and I just said, well, no, I want to try this before I go down that path. And I don't know. I mean, I guess there's circumstances, and as you said, everybody has different situations, and sometimes it could be a life-saving thing for them.
Sure.
So also, doctor, you have a very successful podcast called Decoding Obesity, which I listen to and I find fascinating. The guests you have are amazing. Can you just tell us how that came about and why you do that?
Yeah, so you know, I really started this because when I was going through my journey, I changed my lifestyle and I lost weight, and I say I was lucky because sometimes this lifestyle change doesn't work for people. Or it works and it does, they do not get great results, but just with the lifestyle change, and that can leave a lot of people exasperated. When I went through it, I, like everybody else, thought that this is because of the lifestyle that I had, and it was something that I had to take care of, and it was completely my fault. Now, again, I was lucky that it worked for me, but I decided to kind of pursue this further as a science and see if there's something more to it. I honestly, when I lost my weight, I did not even know that there was a thing as like obesity medicine. And I just happened to Google it and I just found this. So that really got me interested into the science of obesity, and I really wanted to know more about it. So when I learned about it, it really opened my eyes to this field of obesity. Now, this is after having studied medicine in the US and having studied medicine in India. I still did not know much about the science of obesity until I studied for obesity medicine. And that really opened my eyes. And I thought to myself that, well, if I had studied in two separate countries, medicine in two separate countries, and I still did not know about this, I can only imagine what people know about this. I mean, even my colleagues don't know about this as physicians. So I really wanted to get the message out. And that's why I named it Decoding Obesity, because it's so much more than just calories. And I wanted to bring this to light for people so that they can understand that there's a lot of complexity in this, and that there's so much more to it. And there are so many therapeutics that are available that we can help patients with regards to obesity. And that's why I started this podcast.
Yeah, the guests you interview a lot of people in the medical community too, which...
Yeah.
I think it's fantastic for people to listen to, and I'd really urge my listeners to look up Dr. Subwell's podcast, Decoding Obesity, and we'll put the links in the show notes there. And so, doctor, I can't tell you how fantastic it is to talk to you. And one of the benefits of intermittent fasting that I found was, aside from the weight loss, I saw so many things changing in my body. And I often talk to people, I had quite bad psoriasis, and I don't know what the scientific reason was, but I could never get rid of it in my life. And after about 6 months of intermittent fasting, it completely vanished. And I'm not sure what the correlation is. And I interview quite a few people where psoriasis is a problem that do intermittent fasting, but I'm not sure if there's a connection or what happens or what the process is in the body for that sort of thing to heal.
I'm not sure, Graham. I don't know if it was because we know that obesity is a state of chronic inflammation. I don't know if that was what caused it, that the obesity went down and then your psoriasis went down. Again, I don't know. I wouldn't have the right answer for that. But what I can tell you is that even for myself, I used to, when I didn't used to do intermittent fasting, I actually used to carry a travel pillow with me because I used to feel very groggy in the afternoon. What I can tell you is I really started feeling very alert and very focused after I started intermittent fasting. And it was unlike anything that I'd felt before, because the afternoon time would be my worst time of the day when I would just need to take a nap. When I started intermittent fasting, it was probably the best time of my day because I was hyper-focused at that time and, you know, I could get things done. So I don't know how psoriasis would abate. It's probably because the inflammation went down, because obesity is a state of chronic inflammation. But again, I wouldn't be able to tell you exactly what happened.
Yeah, that's fantastic. There's so many health benefits. I think the science is still evolving, isn't it? And,
oh, it is. Absolutely.
I wonder if there's going to be a day, you know, I hope, my own personal hope is that intermittent fasting can become more mainstream. I mean, I'm not sure how mainstream.
I think in the field of obesity medicine, it is still used. I wouldn't say any modality is mainstream or not mainstream, because really what we try to do in obesity medicine is try to cater to the patient. So if a patient wants to try intermittent fasting, by all means, we support that. If the patient wants to try a low-carb diet, we support that. At the end of the day, what's important is what the patient is going to be able to sustain. So that is really, really key, because if somebody wants to try intermittent fasting and they just are not able to sustain it, even if they get phenomenal results with it, the problem is going to be that once they stop doing what they're doing, the weight is going to come back. So as obesity specialists, we are very open to trying different modalities to help the patient, whatever works for the patient.
Yeah, one of the sort of key things for me about intermittent fasting was the fact that I was able to keep the weight off now for some 2 years. And I mean, a lot of diets do work, we know that, but often, as you say, when people stop them and they may go back to their ways, the weight creeps back on, that sort of thing. But I found intermittent fasting as being relatively quite easy to maintain my weight, but
yeah.
I don't know what would happen if I just went back to a 3 meals a day. And
I mean, if it's working for you, you don't need to. I think the good thing about intermittent fasting is it's very easy to do, right? It's just about not eating, and that's the end of it. The only thing that I caution people when they do intermittent fasting is that it doesn't give you a free pass to eat whatever you want to eat when you start eating. That's the only thing that I caution against. I think it's always good to have healthy foods at hand when you're about to break your fast, so that you don't grab that piece of chocolate or, you know, that next granola bar that's just lying on your countertop, because that's really not the point of fasting. I think the point of fasting is to have that state of low insulin levels, and then when you break the fast, you break it with the good foods, not the foods that your body is not going to have. That was never the point.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I always say, make your window worthy, because for me, doctor, I only eat that sort of once a day process. But I did like an OMAD style, like a restaurant style, where I'd open with a healthier snack, as you say, and then maybe have a main meal and sometimes berries or something for dessert. Is that the sort of style you were doing, the OMAD style?
Absolutely. Yeah, so that's what I used to do. So I used to, I used to basically have black coffee during the morning, and I would have some tea during the day. And then basically I would break my fast in the evening. And the reason why I used to do it in the evening now, there's some data coming out to suggest that it's better to eat during the earlier parts of the day and not after sunset or not during the dark. But again, it's still evolving. I used to eat dinner because that was more convenient for me, to just eat one meal, and that was my dinner time. And basically what I would do is I would come home, and before I was about to break my fast, I would just prepare a salad and keep it ready. And then I would break my fast with my salad. So that was my routine every day. So I would just break my fast with my salad. Then after a while, I would have a little bit of dinner. And then after that, I would have something more. And then that was the end of it. So actually, I initially started with 16:8, but it very quickly became 24. So I was eating within a 4-hour window. And I would have 3 or 4 meals, quick meals in that 3 hours or 4 hours, because by the time I was done, it was time for me to sleep. So, you know, that's the other reason why I don't recommend doing it at night. If you can, try to do it during the day, because it's not it's not right to immediately go and lie down on the bed after you've just finished eating, because you're really going to be very hungry when you're eating and you're going to eat a sizable amount of food.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. So, Doctor, we're going to wrap it up in a minute, but I just wonder if obese people out there listening to this podcast, and obviously you've studied a lot and seen a lot of obese people, what's some words of wisdom that you may be able to get some obese people to try and get them motivated to start to do something?
Well, I think the first thing to understand is and accept the fact that it's a disease and we recognize it. The World Health Organization recognizes it as a disease. So that's very important for everybody, whether they are suffering from obesity or whether they're the near and dear ones of people who have obesity, to understand this, that it's a chronic disease and so it should be treated like one. It's not a lifestyle choice. Nobody wants to be at that particular weight or have that amount of excess fat. So that's the first thing I would say. The second thing I would say is that if you're trying something and that hasn't worked, I think you should seek the help of somebody who can help you. Seek the help of an obesity specialist. Seek the help of your primary care physician, because there are excellent therapeutics available. We have so many medications that are available now. We have surgeries. We have different types of surgeries available. And it may not even have to come to that, because you may be, the cause of your obesity may be completely different. It may just be treated by some switching around some of your medications, which again, you know, we as obesity specialists work with your other physicians to kind of get this done. If you're on certain medications that may be causing you to gain the weight, then we can just switch those, try and switch those medications and see if that works for you. So sometimes that works. Sometimes the right lifestyle works. Sometimes if none of this works and we try and get you on medications, that sometimes works. If that doesn't work, then we have surgeries. So we have a lot of modalities that we can use. But I think seeking the help of a specialist who knows how to tackle patients with obesity would be very critical. And then thirdly, I would say that find somebody who can be your buddy in time of need, so to say, an accountability partner, because that becomes very important. It's a treacherous journey. It's not easy. It's a long road, and you do need a buddy when you're going on this journey.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Thank you so much. And also, I would add to that to be patient and give it time, because a lot of obese people, they do get impatient. And I know people I deal with, they think it's going to happen overnight, but I know it took me 55 years to get morbidly obese, Doctor, and it took me 15 months to reverse that. So there is that time situation as well, isn't there?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, so thank you so much, Doctor, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate you joining us here today. I think the insights you give are fantastic, and please listen to Dr. Sabharwal's podcast, Decoding Obesity, and you're also on Instagram, aren't you, Doctor?
I am.
What's your Instagram name?
Yeah, so people can reach me. Basically, I'm on Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook. My handles on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook are Dr. Sabharwal, D-O-C-T-O-R, and then my last name, S-A-B-H-A-R-W-A-L. And they can find me on LinkedIn as well. That's Avishkar Sabharwal.
Thanks so much. And Dr. Avishkar Sabharwal, thank you so much for joining me here on the Fasting Highway.
Thank you so much, Graham, for having me. I'm honored.
Thank you so much. Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Sabharwal. That was fantastic. I really appreciated you coming on the podcast. I think those insights that you just gave us from a medical standpoint were fantastic. And I really urge everybody out there to take a listen to Dr. Sabharwal's podcast, Decoding Obesity. You'll get a lot from it. So coming up next week on Sunday, we've got Andy Watson. And Andy is from London in the UK. And Andy's weight loss journey has been nothing short of remarkable. In fact, he just reached a milestone today where he lost an incredible amount of weight. We're going to hear all about Andy's journey on Sunday. And also, just to the people that have been buying my book out there on Amazon, The Fasting Highway, thank you so much. I know a lot of you saying that you're resonating with it. Thank you for the great reviews and joining my Facebook group, the Fasting Highway Facebook group. Please come and join us there. It's groups growing every day. And also for people that follow me on Instagram, thank you also for sharing the book and that sort of thing. So anyway, until next week, be well, be safe, and remember, clean fasting is everlasting.